watches. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, or WXXC Truxton. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. Tonight's program will be devoted entirely to the presentation of a speech by Tim Wise, a Nashville-based author and lecturer on the subject of institutionalized racism in American society. Wise, who is white, strives in his work to make visible to white people how the system of white supremacy operates and the consequences it has for all of us. Wise has spoken on over 200 college and high school campuses, to dozens of community groups and labor unions, and has trained corporate and government officials on equity and racism issues. His speeches and writings have been termed revolutionary, prophetic, inspiring, captivating, and courageous by fellow activists and educators around the world. The speech we are about to play was given last weekend at a conference in Columbus, Ohio, that dealt with building alliances between progressive movements. Wise titled his talk, Beyond Diversity, Challenging Racism in the Age of Backlash. That title doesn't really do it justice. What he addressed was the reality of how divided this nation is, the media hype of war and unity notwithstanding.
Hold you alive in this darkness and midnight.
I don't get to speak all that often at events that are sort of consciously called together for the purpose of discussing coalition building or organizing. And so it's nice to be able to do that, and particularly important that I do that given the subject matter that I discuss, which is, in fact, racism. And certainly if we're going to talk about coalition building for progressive causes or progressive movement building, as the program, as I recall, says, building alliances for progressive action, if we're going to do that, it is going to be extremely important that the issue of racism be put first and foremost, if not first and foremost, out front and certainly central to the work that's being done. And a lot of times that isn't done. A lot of times progressive activism, left activism, ends up being so overwhelmingly white. And as I looked out last night at the crowd that was here for Michael's talk, I could not help but notice that it was an extremely white bunch of folks. And although that's fine and good, and there's certainly nothing wrong with white folks being involved in social justice activism, if we're talking about building real alliances and actually transforming the culture and transforming this country on any issue, we're going to have to talk about ways to make sure that the next time that a conference like this takes place, the room is considerably less white. Because the reality is, just as we would not expect a capitalist to liberate the country from economic oppression in the class system, just as we would not expect men to liberate us from patriarchy and sexism, we cannot really expect white people to liberate us from institutional white supremacy and racism. So we're going to have a much more broad-based movement and meeting the next time around. It's not a criticism, per se, of this one. It's just to say, let's continue to do the work and make sure that that alliance building really takes place. It's interesting to be here at a time like this and for a movement like this or a meeting like this, because, you know, there are those out there in the larger society, and this might very well explain why the media didn't think this was fit to attend, and why certain folks on the campus have not been particularly forthcoming and helpful about opening rooms or whatever else may be the case. Because to hear a lot of people talk in this country, there is no need to have a meeting like this to discuss building alliances for progressive action, because if you listen to the mainstream rhetoric in this country right now, we are a nation united. We are all one people. We are all one nation. We are all holding hands and unified and all of one purpose and of one mind. So why would we need to have a conference about building alliances? Aren't we already allied? Why do we have to have a conference about building real unity? Don't we already have real unity? Well, that's what we're hearing ever since September 11, the idea that somehow now we are one people, we are one nation. Now, I would suggest to you, and you know this is false, but let me just say it anyway, because we need to make sure we understand it to take it out there where other folks don't get it, that although we may as a nation be united in a certain degree of grief or shock or horror at what happened, which was a terrible, horrible incident to be sure, we are certainly not united in anything beyond that. And behind the facade of unity that we continue to hear about and that we continue to hear talking heads and media pundits and politicians rattle off and prattle about, behind the facade of that unity is a great degree of disunity. And the danger is that if, in fact, we continue to allow the dominant discourse to be one of unity, and aren't we all one people, and aren't we all proud to be standing together, then we end up papering over the very real divisions that continue to beset the country. And if we paper over them, then by definition, we're not going to solve them. I would suggest to you that as long as people of color, and again, I focus on race, there are other issues that prove disunity, but I focus on race, as long as people of color continue to suffer poverty rates that are 2.5 to 3.5 times the rate of their white counterparts, infant mortality rates that are 2 to 2.5 times higher than their white counterparts, we're not really a nation united. That would be true of black folks, Latinos, of many Asian Pacific Islanders, and Native peoples. So as long as we have that level of institutional inequity, to talk about us being one nation united is preposterous. The reality is that if African Americans alone, to say nothing of Latinos, indigenous persons, Asian Pacific Islanders, or any other person of color beyond African Americans, if black folks alone had equal access to nutrition, health care, adequate housing, and protection from environmental hazards, if they had the same protection and the same access to good housing, health care, etc., as white folks do, approximately 75,000 blacks per year in this country would not die above and beyond what they do. In other words, the excess mortality rate for African Americans in this country from unequal health care, unequal housing, unequal access to clean environments is 75,000 people every single year dying above and beyond what we would consider normal and natural, and the rate of death, the death rate, let's say, for white folks of the same economic status, same rough educational background or professional status. That is a significant amount of institutional death. And yet I would suggest to you that we very rarely talk about that. We very rarely focus on the institutional inequities. We don't focus on it before September 11th, and we certainly aren't focusing on it after September 11th. And of course, to believe that we're a nation united, given the fact that our nation in so many ways has now turned against very viscerally and very viciously members of our own nation who are Arab or Muslim or perceived Arab or Muslim, 900 hate crime incidents that we know of in the country so far since September 11th, calls from all quarters of the media and political spectrum to continue to increasingly racially profile at airports. And I don't know how many of you have been in airports since 9/11, but I've been in airports every week at least once since September 11th. And I can tell you that on every single flight that I have been on, the process of who is being pulled aside to be searched, who is being looked at, whose bags are being gone through has been an extremely and blatantly racist practice. Now, if you're on a plane where there's nothing but white people, of course, they got to, you know, take a couple white folks out and search them too, because, you know, you can't not search anybody just because there's nobody of color on the plane. So they keep up appearances and they do it random. But the random selection of people to search no longer continues to be random when some people of color are on the plane. And it's not just people who are Arab or perceived as Arab, Muslim or perceived as Muslim. It could be any African American. It could be any Latino. Anyone with dark skin at all is being pulled off and searched. It doesn't matter whether it's a whole family of people, which don't fit any profile of any plane hijacker or any, you know, doesn't have to fit any profile, as absurd as they are anyway. Those persons are being taken off and searched. And so to see that kind of thing on a regular basis, as of course people of color in this country have seen that kind of thing, and those of us who are white and pay attention to it have seen it for years anyway, is to, I think, pretty clearly give the lie to the notion that we are a nation united. But it's not just the poverty rate differentials or the unemployment differentials or the infant mortality rate differentials. It's also the more subtle things, the less fatal aspects of racism, but the very subtle signs, or perhaps not so subtle, but more subtle than institutional death, that indicate we're very much a divided nation. When you see the growth of the prison industrial complex, which does indeed snare a disproportionate number of people of color, it's very hard to believe we're a united nation. In 1964, 2/3 of all the people locked up in jails and prisons around this country, both local, state, and federal level, 2/3 of all the people locked up were white. Only 1/3 of the people locked up were people of color. That's 1964. By 1994, a mere 30 years later, those numbers had exactly flip-flopped. So that by 1994 and still today, approximately 2/3 of those who are locked up in jails or prisons around this country are people of color, mostly African American and Latino, and only 1/3 are white. Now, there are only two possible theories to explain the difference between 1964 and the present, only two possible explanations for this flip-flop in terms of who is locked up and who is not. The first is the following, and I guess maybe some people believe this, although it seems fairly laughable to me. The first theory is to say, well, you know, after 1964, white folks woke up and just decided, you know, we're tired of all this crime stuff we've been doing. So we're just going to shape up and fly right. We're tired of all this. We've been filling the jails and prisons, and we're over it. We're just going to stop. And then black people and Latinos, seeing that white folks were tired of crime, decided, well, hell, if they're not going to do it, we're just going to move right on in there, you know, and we'll do it now. Now, that's theory number one, somehow to believe that white folks stopped committing crime and black and brown folks decided that it was their turn and went on some kind of crime spree. That would be theory number one. Theory number two, which I think is a little bit more deep and no doubt more accurate, is that over that 30-year period, it wasn't a matter of white crime as a share of overall crime diminishing or black and brown crime as a share of overall crime increasing, because in fact, the percentages didn't really change very much. In fact, the rate of African-American crime has not changed hardly anything in the last 25 years. But what has happened is an increased concentration of law enforcement resources in dollars, police, et cetera, in communities of color. And I would say it's not a coincidence that that happened after 1964, you see. Sort of like what Michael was talking about last night. If we're going to really get to the heart of the issue of why the prison industrial complex has grown so dramatically in the last 30 to 35 years, and why it has been a phenomenon that has disproportionately trapped not only poor folks, but specifically poor people of color, we have to recognize that in 1964, we had a very significant turning point in the middle of the 1960s, whereby formal discrimination was outlawed, so that mechanism of social control known as Jim Crow was no longer allowed. So if you have one mechanism of social control keeping certain people, quote unquote, in their place that is no longer going to be allowed, it is now outlawed. If you still nonetheless want to keep certain people in control, and that desire didn't go away just because a law got passed, you have to have a different mechanism to do it. How do you do that? Well, you increasingly criminalize certain people. And certain actions can be criminalized, and then you focus your attention on only certain people committing those actions. Because, you know, 60% of all violent crime in America is committed by white people, white non-Hispanics. 60% of all violent crime, but whites are only 23% of the persons locked up for violent crime in this country. So it isn't just that violent crime is illegal, that certain forms of violence are illegal. It's that only certain people who commit acts of violence are considered criminal. And that's even true at the street level, let alone at the level of corporate crime, which, of course, is not considered crime at all. It's considered malfeasance. You know, it's considered fraud. It's considered an unfortunate byproduct of the economy. So if a company puts out a faulty product that kills thousands of people, if Ford Motor Company puts the Pinto on the street knowing full well that it's going to kill people and injure them, but decides, you know, it would cost way too much to fix this design flaw. It would cost $13 a car. We really can't afford that. So let's just put the car out there and we'll pay off the victims of the dead. We'll pay off the families of the people injured. That's what we'll do. And Lee Iacocca is the one who made that decision. But after doing that, he wasn't looked at as a corporate criminal or a murderer, even though people did die as a result of the design flaw in the Ford Pinto. He was looked at as a potential presidential candidate. So it's not only that violence is criminalized, it's that certain people's violence is taken more seriously than other people as a mechanism of social control. The war on drugs, of course, a perfect example of that. 74% of all the persons in this country who use illegal narcotics are white like me. That's not to say that I use illegal narcotics, but I am white. I'm follow the analogy here. I'm not outing myself in any way with regard to that. 74% of all the illegal drug users are white, but we are only 10% of the persons locked up for drug offenses. Black folks are 14% of all drug users, roughly the same as their share of the population, but they are 74% of those locked up for a drug offense. Latinos are 10% of all drug users, but 15% of those locked up. If you add the Latino and black numbers together, you very quickly discover that Latinos and blacks are only about 24% of all drug users, about a quarter of all drug users, but they are 90% of the persons incarcerated for a drug offense. And that, more so than any other aspect of the justice system, explains the disproportionate increase since 1964 of the percentage of persons in prison who are people of color. This one policy, this war on drugs, this particular way that we have fought this war on drugs is institutionally racist and explains a lot of what has gone on there. So to see that kind of thing happening and yet to believe that we are one nation, that we are united, that we are all together is, of course, completely fraudulent. It's not just that, though. It's also the rollback of really what are even minimal civil rights gains in the last 35 years. You know, as a radical, I never really expected some years ago that I would find myself doing a lot of work to try to defend something as minimal as affirmative action. I never really thought that I would have to actually go to the mat and fight for something which is really, frankly, a very reformist, very minimal type of thing. But the reality is I'm having to do that, and so is anybody who actually cares about racial equity in this country, because these minimal things like affirmative action, which can only do a certain amount in terms of rectifying racial inequity, and of course was never really designed to do all that much, but is still important on the basis of principle, that is so much under attack right now that if we don't defend it, if we're not very clear and resolute about it, it will definitely go away, and with it will go a significant amount of momentum that we had begun to develop, let's say 30 and 35 years ago. And so now we see the rollbacks of affirmative action programs in California and Washington, the University of Texas, now the University of Georgia, which lost one lawsuit recently and just decided yesterday not to pursue that into a higher court, which means now you have colleges all around the country, whether they have been sued or not on the basis of affirmative action, who are beginning to capitulate to these right-wing organizations that are funding these lawsuits against schools. They're afraid they're going to get sued, so they're sort of preemptively getting rid of their affirmative action programs. And you see now the University of Michigan, of course, there was a split decision in the court, the district court there, a few months back, that decided that it was okay for the University of Michigan undergraduate to have affirmative action, but not the law school. And so now the circuit court is going to resolve this in Cincinnati in December. And if you were here last night, it was announced that December 7th is a day of action. People will be in Cincinnati to demonstrate as the court is ostensibly making that decision or considering that case. And I would highly recommend anyone who can get to Cincinnati for that to be there for those demonstrations to go, because it is an extremely important thing that people step out and step forward and claim not only the moral high ground with regard to this, frankly, very minimal thing, but hopefully push forward a larger agenda of racial justice and equity. It's not just affirmative action. Last term, the Supreme Court restricted civil rights law in a way that really even those of us who are very cynical about the court had not expected. I don't know if you're familiar with Title VI of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, but Title VI has always been one of the primary mechanisms by which civil rights law could be forwarded. Title VII was always sort of weak. That's the part that deals with employment discrimination. And to really prove a strong case of employment discrimination, you always sort of had to bring forth some proof of intent that the employer, you know, sort of had these policies that intentionally discriminated. But with Title VI, you didn't. Title VI has to do with racism or discrimination or gender equity in public accommodations or public things like schools, for example. And so for many years, all you had to do to prove that there was racism in the school system in a particular locale and then remedy that was to take a Title VI case to the court and say the result of so-and-so a policy has been inequity. You didn't have to prove intent. You didn't have to show that some horrible, evil person sat down and said, we're going to intentionally screw black and brown people. All you had to show was that a certain policy had that effect, and you could theoretically get some relief. You could theoretically win a suit. But unfortunately, in the last term, the Supreme Court changed that and said that, in fact, now to win a Title VI case, you also have to prove intent to harm, intent to discriminate. But of course, you know, we're way past the days when folks put out no blacks need apply signs. We're way past the days when people are so stupid as to be so blatantly obvious in their racism. And so to prove intent is a very difficult thing. And the legal standards for proving it are almost impossible to meet, even when the evidence is there. So that has made it far more difficult for those of us who want to push some level of racial equity analysis through the courts to use that mechanism, because it is increasingly hostile. Again, proof that we're not one nation united. And the folks that are behind this, let us be clear about who the adversary is. The folks that are bringing these lawsuits, the folks that are attacking racial equity, the title of my speech, you know, is Beyond Diversity, Challenging Racism in an Age of Backlash. Let us be clear about who the folks pushing this backlash are. They are groups like the Center for Individual Rights, a very inappropriately named organization, which if you were only to hear its title, you might think, well, this is a good bunch. You know, the Center for Individual Rights, why, they'll probably be opposed to, you know, the new terrorism bill that clearly has nothing to do with protecting individual rights. Surely they'll be out there lobbying against that. And surely they would be opposed to the war on drugs because of the violations of individual rights that have come along with that, particularly the racist application of it. Surely they would care about that. But in reality, they don't, of course, because they're not really about individual rights. They're about protecting the rights of people with power and property against the rest of us. So if you look at their website, I mean, here's a bunch that actually went out and solicited lawsuits in college newspapers last year. Took out big ads in the newspapers of college campuses saying, you know, have you or somebody you know been the victim of reverse discrimination? Does your school have an unfair quota program? If so, you know, call us and we will sue your school for you. It's very intoxicating type advertising, you know, very good marketing. And, of course, they found some people, you know, to potentially push some of these lawsuits. And they're the folks who were behind the Hopwood decision in Texas. They're the folks who sued the University of Washington. They're the folks suing the University of Michigan. And to hear them tell it, you know, all they want is for everyone to be treated equally. They really believe in civil rights. You know, they constantly conjure up the image of Martin Luther King Jr. in their advertising or in their other work, and they say, and they take this one quote from Dr. King, the only quote they probably ever heard, from the only speech they ever saw, completely out of context, right, the content of character statement, not recognizing that, in fact, Dr. King, in the book that he wrote the very year he gave that speech, and Why We Can't Wait, in 1963, articulated very openly and clearly the need for affirmative action programs, both as a way to rectify the history of inequity and also to prevent ongoing discrimination. But they ignore that aspect of King's analysis. They present themselves as these apostles of colorblindness in the ideological line of Dr. King, even as they actually support more than just getting rid of affirmative action, even as they support eliminating the Civil Rights Act itself. Now, if you read their materials on their website, this is what makes it very clear. The Center for Individual Rights' own mission statement says that they believe in a limited application of civil rights law, which sounds sort of amorphous and you don't really know what that means. And then you read the next sentence, that would allow corporations to deal with individuals as they see fit. Now, again, somewhat amorphous unless you understand what that means. What that means is that they don't believe in any level of, quote-unquote, government interference in the affairs of corporations or companies, private sector employers, those who are property owners. What does that mean? It means that it's not just about getting rid of affirmative action. It's about getting rid of Title VII, of Title VI, of Title IX, of the entire Civil Rights Act, getting rid of the Fair Housing Act, because that does what? That intrudes on a property owner's right to dispense with their property however they see fit, by potentially discriminating against someone they don't want to live in that neighborhood or whatnot. So they want to get rid of all those things. So we're not talking about a movement that is purely about ending what they call preferential treatment. We're talking about a movement, in fact, that wants to codify and enshrine preferential treatment into the law, into the society, as it has always been enshrined and codified. That is to say, to continue to grant preferential treatment to property owners who were disproportionately white and not by accident so. Right? Because it is no coincidence that the property owners who would be protected under an analysis like this or a legal system like this happen to be disproportionately white. It didn't just happen. And the good folks at the Center for Individual Rights know that it didn't just happen. So their movement is much more pernicious than what even those who are typically, you know, sort of regular liberals would want us to believe. You know, they would say, you know, typical liberals would say, well, they just really don't understand the issue. And maybe if we just put out a good position paper that explains why affirmative action is good, you know, then we'll convince people. Now, these folks know exactly what they're doing. And the people who are behind them know exactly what they're doing. The center has received funding from the Pioneer Fund, for example. If you know anything about the Pioneer Fund, and by the way, whenever I say this, I need to clear it up because people hear me say Pioneer Fund, and some of you might know some people that have investments in this thing called Pioneer. It's like an IRA thing or something. It's like, so I don't know. I don't have any investments. But I keep hearing people always say, my God, I think I have money in that fund, you know. And no, it's not that. The Pioneer Fund that I'm talking about is actually a right-wing foundation that for approximately 60 years or so has been funding research with the purpose, the express purpose of proving the genetic superiority of European people and the genetic inferiority of people of color. In fact, this organization was founded in the 1930s by open admirers of Adolf Hitler, and over the years they have funded William Shockley and Arthur Jensen and Philippe Rushton and all these guys that have done all this research to try and prove how inferior black and brown folks are, and they also fund groups like the Center for Individual Rights. So here's a group that's really a eugenic organization that really believes in controlling the reproduction of people of color. And in the case of William Shockley, who they used to fund back in the 60s, who believed in giving extra, you know, bonuses to white people to have lots of kids. This is an organization with an expressly neo-Nazi type agenda, and they are funding not only the neo-Nazi research, things like the bell curve and things of that nature, but also funding, in effect, these groups that seem to be quite quote-unquote mainstream in the sense that they operate very much above board. They don't make overtly racist comments, but that is where they get their money. And you can tell a lot about a group by where they cash their check. The problem with this is that our response, and when I say our response, I don't want to fall into the trap that I think Michael Perini expressed very clearly last night. We talk about we don't want to use this as if we're all behind this particular inadequate response, and we're certainly not, those of us in this room, I would assume, behind this assault on everything from affirmative action to the growth of the prison industrial complex. But in general, I would suggest that those persons who define themselves as progressive, which is also a very amorphous term, I'm not sure what it means. I mean, I really don't know what it means. A lot of people call themselves progressive, and we really don't know what it means. We use the term because, frankly, we're more afraid to use the term radical. Because the word, it's true. I mean, this is just true. I'm not saying there's anything wrong like with this saying for progressive action. It's cool, but let us just be clear. You know, let's just little self-deprecation is good. We use the term because we are afraid to use the term radical. We're afraid to use the term leftist because these terms have been smeared. Now, progressive is also so amorphous, though it can be smeared. You know, liberal means nothing at all. That's really very worthwhile for us. So we know that these terms that we use and the movements that we then build, because anybody can sort of say they're progressive and sort of come under that rubric. Right? So you have a lot of people who are quote-unquote progressive who really their analysis is not particularly radical. And when I say radical, I mean to the root of the problem, you know, what Michael was talking about last night, just the pure grammatical dictionary definition of the term. I'm not talking about the stylistic aspects of radicalism. That's pose. That's not the actual product. You know, the style, the tone of voice, the level of militance that you, you know, exude, that's not what makes one radical. That, in fact, can be quite reactionary depending on the situation. It's really about the analysis. And so a lot of people under the rubric of progressivism will attempt to respond to racism. And so we have a lot of people who call themselves anti-racist. We have a lot of people who consider themselves to be doing work against racism. And some of that work is very good, but I would suggest to you that a lot of it is inadequate, because it doesn't really get to the root of the problem. I mean, so you have people who, in response to an issue like police brutality, for example, which is a very serious issue. It's a serious issue in this town, as you well know, or as you should know. It's a very serious issue in many towns across this country and others in this state that have been in the news, obviously, very much in recent months. And yet, what is the response of a sort of traditional liberal to that? You know, the response of a traditional liberal is, well, you know, we just need to have a more diverse police force. So we'll just hire some black people, hire some Latinos, you know, and by virtue of having more diversity in the workforce, we'll have less police brutality. Well, James Baldwin, who I think probably understood these issues as well as anyone, grew up in Harlem, wrote about these very issues, used to say, you know, in Harlem, we were most afraid of black cops because they had something to prove. Because they didn't work for black people. They didn't answer to black people. They answered to white folks who actually dominated the culture of policing, whether it was the mayor, whether it was the chief of police, whether it was the city council, whether it was ultimately, you know, the business community in a particular area. So cops of color, and that's not to say that, you know, there aren't some benefits to having an increased level of representation within the force, but the reality is the culture of policing, the culture of domination and subordination that comes with law enforcement takes a person of color in that situation and essentially will be more likely to bend them to the needs and dictates of a white supremacist society and system than that person will be able to change the culture of policing in and of themselves. So this liberal response to police brutality, which is let's get some black people on the force, won't necessarily work. You know, a study came out about a year ago that found that black police officers were just as likely to engage in physical abuse of suspects as white officers. Now, of course, the right, what did the right say? You know, conservatives said, aha, see, the police aren't racist because even the black cops do it. Now, that's not the right analysis, right? I mean, the reality is that the system of white supremacy can be inculcated and replicated by people who are not themselves white. It's the system that is the problem. And if the system is being enforced, I mean, you know, there were always people who were of color who collaborated with slave owners, but that didn't mean that system wasn't racist. There were always people who turned in slaves that tried to run away. It didn't mean that system was any less racist. So you can find individuals who are of color who will, in fact, do the bidding of those who are white and who actually run that larger system or the subsystem, the criminal justice system or whatever else, and that won't keep the system from being racist. The problem is the institution itself. It is not necessarily the skin color of those who run that institution, although that clearly can be a problem as well if, as is usually the case, those of us who have this particular melanin deficiency that I suffer from are running those institutions, because there's no question that we have more of a stake in accepting that system, certainly. But people of color who want to move up within those systems as well, as long as the system remains white-dominated, have to sort of play that game. And the unfortunate thing is that then translates into a lot of people of color who end up doing the bidding, not of the communities from which they come, but instead doing the bidding of those who actually call the shots in that institution. The same is true with the sort of progressive or liberal reaction to the assault on affirmative action. What has been the primary reaction? What has been the primary response? Look at what the schools, for example, that are being sued because of their affirmative action policies. What are they doing? Well, you know, they're fighting to preserve their affirmative action programs, or at least they say they are. So they go to court, and they also go into the court of public opinion, and they do what? They say, well, we need to have affirmative action because we need to have a diverse student body. That's their argument. That's what they go to the court with. diversity is a good thing. And then they trot out, you know, some studies that try and prove that. And some of these studies show what? That, you know, students that are educated in a diverse multicultural setting are more likely to develop empathy, more likely to do all kinds of wonderful things. They tend to get along better, all this stuff. And there are some studies that indicate they, you know, get more involved in the community when they get out of college. Okay, I'll just assume for the sake of argument all those studies are right. They probably are. But what is wrong with this argument? Well, the problem is that this argument does not get to the core of why affirmative action was created. Affirmative action was not created so that we could get some white folk and black folk and brown folk and whatever in a room holding hands, singing Kumbaya, and learning from one another's experience. Because this is what they say. They say, well, now, if we can get people of color in those schools that are mostly white, that means white folks will be able to learn from the different experiences that people of color have had, and they'll talk about those in class. Well, what is the question being begged here? You know, this argument that somehow we need to learn from one another's experience, which I think is true, begs the question of why is it that white people and everybody else have such different experiences in the first place? Right? That's the fundamental question, because if we had equity, if we did not have a system of institutional racism, historically and still today, our experiences wouldn't be that different, such that we needed to be in a room learning about each other's different experiences. Right? The thing that has caused these different experiences in the first place is a society based on a notion of inequity. So now white folks have to learn something from black people's experiences. Why? Because, well, 86% of us live in communities where there are no black people. Right? That's what the data indicates. About 90% of whites nationwide who live in suburbs live in areas with less than 1% people of any color other than their own, which means we're isolated from them. So now if we're going to learn, we got to learn from them in that room. But we don't ask the question, why are we in such white spaces in the first place? Why is our neighborhood not more diverse to begin with? Why does the school have to go out of its way to increase diversity? Why isn't it automatically diverse to begin with? That's the question. But the liberals who are trying to save affirmative action don't want to argue that, because they're afraid to talk about institutional racism. So they prefer to talk about diversity. And, oh, it's, you know, Norm Rice, who was the mayor of Seattle, first black mayor of Seattle, I listened to him at a speech in Portland a couple years ago, and he was talking about all the wonderful things about affirmative action at this conference, and he listed about 25 reasons why affirmative action was important to preserve. The word racism never came out of his mouth. He said things like, we need to have all hands on deck for a 21st century economy. He said things like, we need to learn from each other's experience. He said all these things that were right out of sort of the corporate handbook for diversity about, you know, we want to increase our productivity. You know, we want to tap our human potential. I mean, all this sort of, this is a dead language. This business English is not a language, but we speak it very well, and we're very fluent in it. But it has no resonance. It doesn't mean anything. So here's a good guy. I mean, Norm Rice, from what I understand, is a decent man, and probably, here's the bad part, he probably knows. In fact, I'm sure he knows that the real issue is institutional racism, but it's functional for him not to talk about that. It's functional for him to forget that, just like what Pereni talked about last night. If you say certain things that are true, even when you know they are true, then you're not going to be able to get on the talk show. You're not going to be able to become mayor of a city. You're not going to be taken seriously. And so you water down your analysis. And even if you know what the truth is, you're not able to really say it, which is why it's important for movements, you know, for racial justice or anything else, to be talking about the truth, to keep people like that honest. Because even when somebody knows the truth, it is more functional for them oftentimes to repress it. And so we don't talk about institutional racism. Now, why is that dangerous? Well, if we're going to defend something like affirmative action, let alone go beyond that and talk about what we really ought to be talking about, which frankly involves a lot more than affirmative action. It involves fundamental, widespread, systemic reparations for people of color damaged by institutional racism, by slavery, by Jim Crow. It involves serious autonomy for native peoples who have been colonized within this country, and every treaty we ever signed with them we have broken. It involves a lot more than mere piecemeal reform. But now if we're going to ever get to reparations, if we're ever going to get to autonomous decision-making, if we're ever going to get to that kind of thing, well, we surely aren't going to get there talking about diversity. Right? We're going to have to talk about the real deal. We're going to have to talk about institutional racism. And see, the right knows this. Because what they do is they know when we, you know, back 30 years ago, when folks were talking about affirmative action programs and why they were needed, not only to repair damage from the past, but even more importantly, to prevent ongoing bias from continuing to take place today, they were arguing about institutional racism. The argument was, if you don't have these programs, people of color will continue to be systemically excluded. That's an argument about racism. Nobody was talking about diversity, multiculturalism. You know, my Speakers Bureau agent, you know, lived in Cuba for 10 years. When she came back to the U.S., tells this funny story. She said when she left America, left the Americas, well, of course, Cuba is still part of the Americas, left the United States to go to the island in the 1970s, everybody was talking on the left about racism. I mean, at least that was the term that was being used. That was the analysis. I mean, we weren't winning. We weren't carrying the day, but that was the terminology. She came back, and all she saw were these, you know, celebrate difference or celebrate diversity stickers on cars. And it was interesting. She said she never saw a person of color really with that sticker. A lot of white folks had it. Had to celebrate diversity, you know, using these very watered down terminology to talk about something which 15 years earlier we had a very clear understanding was really about racism. And not just interpersonal racism, you know, the sort of 12-step, you know, self-help thing that people now, it's like, that's what they view racism as. It's like, oh, I don't like you. I need to get my prejudice dealt with, instead of looking at it systemically. So over a 10 or 15-year period, this sort of went away. Now, the right knows this. So when the right listens to liberals defend affirmative action on the basis of diversity, knowing full well that 30 years ago we were talking about it on the basis of institutional racism, what do? They're smart. And they say, well, now look, if you're not talking about institutional racism anymore, maybe there just must not be any. Right? So even you know the problem isn't there, because if it was, you'd be talking about it. But you're not. You're just talking about diversity. And so really, the importance of affirmative action is far less. So why don't we just get rid of it? And the courts agree with them. The courts are saying what? That diversity is not a compelling interest. So if the other side is saying, well, white people are being victimized by reverse discrimination, this is a serious principle. They're talking about the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. Now, they're wrong about the effect of affirmative action. All the data indicates it, but they make that argument. They're arguing a principle, unfair preferential treatment, unfair reverse discrimination, and we're talking about singing kumbaya and learning from one another's experiences. I would suggest to you that no court is going to consider that as compelling as this other thing that the right is talking about. So if we want to actually preserve affirmative action, let alone to move forward into a discussion about systemic reparation and repair and investment and development, then we're going to have to talk about the problems that actually exist, the institutional racism itself, in the labor market. White males with a high school diploma just as likely to have a job as black or Latino males with a college degree. And even when you control for age and education and years of experience and geographic location, on average, blacks and Latinos and indigenous persons earn anywhere from 10 to 25% less than similarly qualified or oftentimes even less qualified white males. In the area of education, even when people of color, black and Latino children in particular, even when they take that eighth grade achievement test that we all take right before we go into high school, and that's the test we take that sort of determines like what classes are we going to be put in, you know, when we get to ninth grade and 10th grade, and it's used as a way to track and to sort, you know, supposedly on the basis of ability, which tracking is not really about, that never has been. When we take those tests, even when black and Latino students score at the top of the distribution, so even when black and Latino students do very well using the biased and absurd indicators that we use in this country, they're still 40% less likely to be put into an advanced placement class or an honors class in high school than white students who scored in the middle of the distribution. So you have average white students, according to this criteria, and of course the criteria is bogus, but understand it's the one we use. Using this criteria, white students who are merely average are still more likely to have advanced or accelerated classes once they get to high school. Now, what does that mean? It means that those students are going to get more prepared for the SAT, right? They're going to get more prepared for the ACT. They're going to take the test, and they're going to do better. And we're going to act shocked when people of color do worse on a test that they were systemically excluded from preparing for, as if that is a surprise. I mean, black and Latino students of whatever socioeconomic status, 2.5 times more likely than whites to be put into remedial classes, where they're not going to receive the same instruction, they're not going to have the same coursework, they're not going to be challenged in the same way, right? And so we then act surprised when in 11th grade they take the SAT, the ACT, they don't do as well, and then our society says, what? Well, now you're not capable of going on to college, or at least not that college, because you're not as smart as somebody else over here. The fact that the structure of the educational system guaranteed that you would not do as well, virtually assured it, is something we don't want to talk about. But that's the systemic issue. And Perini talked about it last night. We have a society that doesn't want everybody to get a college education. It's not functional for everyone. I mean, if everyone gets a college degree, who's going to sweep the floors, right? Who's going to clean the streets? Who's going to empty the bedpans in the hotels of this country? Who's going to do that work? Who's going to pick strawberries from dawn to dusk as migrant labor if everybody has access to a college degree, if everybody has access to a job? We don't have a society where we really want everybody to have a job. That's why the Federal Reserve raises interest rates whenever unemployment drops too low. What does that mean? Unemployment is too low. Now, how is that? I mean, people are out of work, but that's good. If you're Alan Greenspan, that's good. So if unemployment drops below, let's say, 4%, oh my God, we got to do something. We got to stop that. Stop all that hiring. Jesus, stop hiring people. So how do we stop hiring people? Well, we can't force them, but we can raise the interest rates. We'll increase the cost of borrowing money, right, to expand your business. That'll stop you from hiring. And if we do it once and it doesn't stop you, we'll do it again, and we'll do it again, and we'll do it again. And pretty soon, what do you know? The hiring spree does stop, and we sort of settle in at 4%, 4.5% unemployment, which really isn't 4% or 4.5% unemployment. It's really more like 9% because the people aren't counted who have just given up and stopped looking for work. The people aren't counted who are in prison or in jail. If you were to add all these folks into the unemployment numbers, it would be about double what it really is. So we're looking at maybe 8%, 9%, maybe 10%, which translates to about 10 to 12 million people at any given moment out of work, even when the economy is at full employment. So you have 10 to 12 million people out of work, not because they're lazy, certainly not because, as the bell curve says, their genes and DNA are messed up, but instead because we have a system that says that many people must be unemployed to keep inflation low. That's the logic, because if too many people are working, my God, workers will have more power, they'll push for higher wages, oh God forbid that would happen, then prices would go up. Milk might cost $2.50 a gallon. Of course, the fact that people had work and could pay for that, you know, never seems to enter anybody's mind, but we don't want the prices to go up. So we keep unemployment relatively high. We have 10 to 12 million people out of work because our society makes that necessary. And of course, that has a class component, also has a race component, because it's not functional to have those 10 to 12 million people be mostly white. That would not do, you see, because if you had that many people who were of the dominant racial group, who were the ones out of work, right, the ones who by virtue of being out of work would then be poor, right, the disproportionate numbers of people who were poor then having to receive some form of public assistance, that little bit that still exists, if those numbers were disproportionately in the white community, well, that would not be acceptable to the vast majority of that community, and so something would be done about it. So we can't allow that. We have to make that system not only one that hurts people at the bottom of the economic ladder, but that hurts those who are most disempowered racially as well. So the persons who end up having to be victimized, not because of some conspiracy. You don't have to sit down and conspire to have this happen. It's autopilot. It just makes sense. It's just functional for that many people to be out of work to keep the economy strong in the eyes of those who own property and need it to be at a certain level. And also it's functional to have those folks that are mostly harmed by it be people of color because their political power is less. But our responses to this, pushing for diversity and nothing more than that, is simply not enough. We're going to have to talk about these bigger and deeper issues. We're going to have to understand why inequity persists. Just as Michael Perini talked about last night, these things are not accidental. It's very functional to have certain groups of the population viewed as surplus people. So if you go back to the history of slavery in this country, it was very functional to have certain people as surplus. And then when slavery ended, you had this wide array of black persons who were no longer functional to the economy of the South. They were now surplus people. So they had to move where? They moved north. And then as the industries began to move into the suburbs or move now overseas to take advantage of lower or non-existent labor laws, lower or non-existent environmental protection laws, they become surplus once again. Now what do you do with them? Well, you got to lock them up now. I mean, there's very little else you can do at that point. You can either, you know, you could send them away, you could repatriate them, but there's not, at this point, enough support for that, thank God. But you can still lock them up. You can internally colonize, right? And so this mechanism of social control, it's not merely an economic function. Sort of traditional Marxism would argue that, you know, racism is simply some edifice of the class system, that if we just get rid of the class system, you know, or begin to talk about class, that racism would go away. I would suggest it's a little bit more complicated than that, although there is certainly an economic functionality to having people of color be surplus population, because if you have surplus labor, it drives down the wages of all working people. You know, we understand that. But it's more than that. I mean, the criminal justice system functions as a mechanism of social control above and beyond the economy. So to have people of color being disproportionately locked up doesn't just, I mean, it, you know, it's good for the economy in the sense of the image, because those people don't get counted as unemployed, so we look like we're a much stronger and healthier economy, you know, than we are. But also it's a mechanism of social control by use of fear, because if white people see that people of color are the ones disproportionately being marched off to prison and to jail, and if people of color see that as well, what's the result of that? I mean, we live in a society that sort of, you know, has this myth of individualism where wherever you end up on the ladder of life, it's all about you, right? So if you worked really hard, you'll get up here, and you certainly wouldn't go to jail. If you end up down here or in prison, you know, you obviously didn't work as hard. Maybe your DNA was messed up. Your cultural values were bad. So when people see, you know, white folks at the top of the hierarchy, people of color at the bottom and people of color disproportionately locked up, what's the sort of logical conclusion that someone would come to if they weren't thinking critically? They would come to the conclusion that those people being locked up must be the dangerous people, because why else would we be locking them up? They must be the folks we need to fear. Those are the people we don't want in our neighborhood. Those are the people we don't want in our children's school. Those are the people we don't want our children hanging out with, right? Those are the people we don't want in the job, in the company that we work for, because we know there's something wrong with them, because look, all these people are being marched off to prison. So it's a mechanism of control that then allows the system of racism and inequality to be maintained, because the dominant group, even people who themselves are not taught to be racist, even those of us who are white and don't have this sort of overt racial bias, we're still bombarded by these images of who the dangerous folk are, who the failures are in the economy. And unless we have an understanding of the systemic functions of the economy and polity that results in this inequity, we're going to come to this conclusion, even if we're not overtly hateful people, even if we would never join the Klan or a skinhead group or anything like that, we still might very well, or at least enough of us, might come to the conclusion that those are the folks to watch out for. And as long as we're thinking that, that keeps us in line. Because if we're looking out for the danger that comes in black or brown skin, what are we not paying any attention to? We're not paying attention to the damage that corporations do. We're certainly not paying attention to the skin color of the people who make the decisions in those corporations. So we don't call that white crime. What do we call it? White collar crime. Right? But the collar is rarely the only thing lacking color. I mean, normally there is more than just that, right? The term white crime, I mean, doesn't even resonate. You know, when did you ever hear that? When have you ever heard anybody talk about the white crime problem? You don't. But every time there is an increase in the crime rate in a black or brown community, particularly a poor community, there is this discussion that gets played out. What is wrong with the black family? Like there's only one black family, and if we can just figure out what the hell's wrong with them, everything will be fine, right? Now, when Charles Manson and John Wayne Gacy and Jeffrey Dahmer and, thank you very much, and Ted Bundy do what they do, nobody asks what it is about white people that makes them consume human flesh, bury 25 people under the house, right? Because we know fundamentally, and I've written things about school shootings that many of you have seen before, you know, if all of these school shootings, I'm talking about the mass murder shootings, because there have long been acts of violence in poor schools that are disproportionately of color, but it's almost invariably one-on-one. It's somebody's angry with somebody else. This is not to excuse it. It's still terrible, and we don't pay enough attention to it because it doesn't resonate with the people in the suburbs who make the decisions. But these mass murder attempts where somebody comes in and just tries to kill everybody that, you know, not only the girl that dumped them, but also everybody that was at her slumber party the week before. I mean, everybody, you know, and anybody that's in their way, just kill them all. This is a very white, male, suburban, or rural thing. This is a very much a crime that's being committed by these persons sort of at the, really not poor kids. They're not poor white kids doing this. And I would suggest to you that we have to understand that not seeing white dysfunction as white, but regularly seeing black and brown dysfunction as black and brown is a mechanism of social control, and we all fall prey to it. So that when we see that a particular terrorist incident seems to have been perpetrated by persons who are Arab or perceived Arab, Muslim or perceived Muslim, not Afghan, but close enough, you know, we all sort of instinctively respond. And I just let's be honest about this. I was in Florida doing a training with journalists about how to cover race issues and how not to cover race issues on September 11th. And all these people in the room were sort of, you know, progressive, again, for whatever that's worth, people who all of us, you know, were very cognizant of the way that the media was really, you know, intentionally or just as a matter of functionality, sort of hyping this dangerous brown person theory and analysis of what had happened. And we all, however, were honest enough to say, and we better all be honest enough to say, that I doubt very seriously, and I will not believe you if you tell me otherwise, so don't even bother, that any of us, in the wake of that incident, at least did not think for a second, you know, the next time I get on a plane, if I see somebody who looks like that, it's going to enter my mind. And anybody who says that's not true is lying, particularly if they are a dominant group member and say that, because we have been socialized to believe it. I'm not saying we might not resist it. I'm not saying we might not go, damn, I can't believe I thought that. Of course, you know, those of us who care about these issues, we would try and fight that impulse. But to say that impulse wouldn't be there is to somehow believe that individuals can be removed from their socialization, that somehow some of us aren't conditioned by the very same thing that the rest of us are conditioned by. Now, what does that mean? Because, you know, in the wake of Oklahoma City, we did not We did not pull white people off of airplanes. We did not treat white men with crew cuts, with Irish names, as all terror. I rented a Ryder truck 7 months after the Oklahoma City bombing to move back from New Orleans to Nashville. I go into the Ryder truck place to get this moving van, and nobody says to me, now, why do you want a Ryder truck? Because you might have fertilizer and ammonium, whatever it is, that I don't even know how to make one of these bombs, but, you know, they didn't ask me. They just sort of signed the paper. There you go. Okay, make sure to drop it off in Nashville when you get back. Thank you very much.
Is your name Tim?
Yeah. Well, my name's Tim. My name is Tim. I got short hair. I'm white. I fit that profile. And I've been in Spokane, Washington many times when, and for those who don't know a lot about Spokane, it seems to produce this disproportionate share of serial killers. Like three of them are on the loose there right now, and two others are on trial. I mean, it's just amazing that one place can generate so many serial killers. And yet I'm up there when some of these guys are on the loose, and they're all white. I mean, they look probably something like myself, but yet never am I pulled over. Now, of course, we know there is a profile of a serial killer that is a white man, but even though there's a profile, it doesn't get played out the same way. So that white people are not going to be dragged off the street and asked, hey, now, where were you on so-and-so a night, and can we search your car, can we search your house, looking for bloody stuff? You know, we're not going to do that. We're not going to do it. So we all get conditioned this way. We did not respond the same way after Oklahoma City, and I would dare say that if the events of 9/11 had been perpetrated by members of the IRA, we would not right now be bombing Dublin. Now, let us be clear about this. Because if we're going to build coalitions in a time of war, and if we're going to do it effectively and make sure that the room is not only white people, but also people of color, we better make clear that there is an anti-racist analysis that needs to become part of our movement against this war, any other war. Militarism is applied racism in this country's history. That is the way it is played out. Am I suggesting that we've never bombed white people? No, we have. But notice the white people that we bomb really don't count as white to most Americans. Like, we bomb Yugoslavia, right? We will bomb Slavic people, but, you know, they really aren't white in the eyes of most white people in America, because to become white is a process that only happens to Europeans when they come here, right? And light-skinned people when they come here. So, you know, before the Irish came here, the term white didn't make any sense to them, right? Before the Italians came here, the term white, it didn't really make any sense to them. Before Russian Jews, like my great-grandfather, came here, we weren't white. We were whatever we were. We were Russian, Irish, Scottish, German, whatever. But the term white is a term of art developed in this nation to get all those European people, no matter how poor they were, in the same place against people who were of color as a way to divide and conquer and to keep them on the side of the angels, so to speak, those with power and money. And so because Central European Slavic peoples don't have the same level of immigration historically to the United States as Western Europeans, Northern Europeans, and even Eastern Europeans from Russia, they haven't had the same opportunity to become white, so we can bomb them with impunity and not really view them as like ourselves. But notice in World War II, I would make the argument, and I can't prove it, but I think it's a fairly decent analysis if you looked at what led up to our involvement in that war. We didn't care what Germany was doing for 8 years. Not only did we not care, economically we were collaborating with the Nazis. Some of our biggest companies were in bed with the Nazis, did not care what they did to Jews, did not care what they did to gypsies, did not care what they did to homosexuals, didn't care what they did to anybody, until they declared war on us in the wake of Pearl Harbor. And then, of course, well, if a nation declares war on you, you know, you sort of got to go to war. You got to keep up appearances at the very least. And so we end up bombing Germany, to be sure, right? We firebomb parts of their country. We go to war against them. But we waited to the very last moment. And in this country, of course, we did not treat those of German descent the same way we did those of Japanese descent. So even there was this differential level of treatment. Our history of militarism is one that is overtly racist, and right now we would not be bombing Dublin if this had been an IRA action. We find it far easier. What would we do if it was the IRA or Protestant militants opposed to the IRA? What would we do? We would go search for the perpetrators. We would try and find the individuals actually involved, and we'd arrest them. And that's what we ought to be doing here, but it's not what we're doing here. We are indiscriminately talking about bombing people and then trying to justify it by making it seem like we really don't, you know, dislike these people, we love them, that's why we're dropping food to them. We're dropping it in minefields so that to pick it up, you got to blow yourself up first. But, you know, that's okay. And it'll make sure that, you know, those folks who get some of our food rations, why they will have a total, you know, we keep saying things like, what other nation in the history of the world has both bombed and fed at the same time? Well, Not many, but that's because most other nations recognize the utter hypocrisy of doing that. And most other people... And it's obviously absurd. I mean, you know, put yourself in Pearl Harbor on December 7th, 1941. Now, do you really think that the folks who were bombed to oblivion in Pearl Harbor would have thought better of the bombing if the Japanese had made a second run and dropped sushi and edamame on the boats? I doubt seriously that we would have thought that was impressive, or that we would have said, well, we won't go to war now because, you know, you fed us after you bombed us. But we somehow, this arrogance, this sort of cultural arrogance, I don't know where I got off on that tangent, but the reality is that that we have to understand the functionality of this, and we have to understand the way it affects all of our conditioning so that we respond. I mean, when was the last time that Arab peoples in this country, or Muslims of whatever ethnic or national background, were portrayed in the media in any way other than this sort of negative way that they're being portrayed right now? You know, when was the last time you saw a story about Arab peoples or Muslims that was, you know, just going and asking them, well, you know, what do you think about the parks in your community or the schools in your community or daycare or healthcare? You know, treating them like any other member of the society. You can go to Dearborn, Michigan, right? The largest concentration of Arab Americans, the largest concentration of Arabs outside of what we generally consider the Arab world. And you don't see the Detroit newspapers going into that community regularly to talk about those people's dreams and aspirations and everyday lives. But if something happens, a terrorist incident takes place, then all of a sudden, what happens? Well, now we have stories. Now, maybe the stories at their best are the stories where, what, the reporter goes in and tries to find some people in the community that can condemn it. And, of course, it's not hard to find because almost everyone will. So you go in, you find people who say, my God, this was a terrible thing. It's completely against the foundational principles of Islam, etc. But notice that even those stories are still being put out there through the lens of terrorism. So that even at their best, this community's voice is only heard when a terrorist incident happens, which reinforces the mentality that these people are only relevant when something horrible has happened, committed by people who look a lot like them. And so even at their best, I don't have to really view them as fundamentally equal and human to me. They're still only relevant. They only show up on my radar screen when something awful has taken place, right? So that kind of conditioning affects us all. How do we respond to that? Well, first, let us be very clear. We have to make an understanding of the structural components of racism central to our analysis. So much of liberal anti-racism is not about that. It is about fighting individual racist or attitudinal bias, right? Fighting the Klan, fighting neo-Nazis, and fighting skinheads. None of that is bad work, by the way. It's all good. But let us be clear where those people come from, because those are symptoms of a larger issue. They are not the problem. Why would a person come to the conclusion that people of color were less human than themselves and therefore could be eradicated at will or run out of the country or beaten in the form of a hate crime? What would give them that impression? Again, I would suggest to you that if our society, through its own inequity and the treatment of people of color, guarantees that they are disproportionately on the bottom of the labor market, the bottom of the educational system, the bottom of the housing market, and disproportionately being locked up, the impression that that gives to people is precisely that those people are less than human.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Finner Syracuse, or WXXC Truxton. This is Unwelcome Guests. You're listening to a speech by Tim Wise, Beyond Diversity, Challenging Racism in the Age of Backlash. We continue.